From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you read romance fiction, there's a good chance you've hidden the cover of the book at the beach or on the bus. For some reason, there's a kind of shame associated with the genre, that it's frivolous and shallow and tawdry and unrealistic. Most of these books have happy endings, and that can't be real. Well, really? One romance novel writer, Jennifer Cruzy, makes this argument that romance is actually more real than the tragic stories in literary fiction. As a general rule, people don't go around killing themselves for love. Relationships do work out all the time. We're talking about the romance novel today. There's a conference going on in Salt Lake City for people who study the genre, which is giving us an opportunity to talk about why romance novels are so dismissed and why happy endings sell so well. Join us after the news.
Stay connected with KUER throughout the day on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We'll bring you stories from our local news team along with program updates and features from NPR, BBC, and other network providers. Get the scoop on upcoming events, meet your favorite public radio personalities, and find out what's happening at the station behind the scenes by following KUER on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here are a few names. Okay, see if you recognize them. Kay Gibbons, Julie Garwood, Nora Roberts, Eloisa James. They're writers, and they may not seem like household names, but for a certain segment of the American population, a fairly significant segment, they're rock stars. Some of you know the names because you fit into that segment of mostly women who read romance fiction. Now, you may not admit you read the genre. You may hide the glossy, dramatic covers of couples embracing in the sunset, but romance novels bring in more than $1 billion a year. Last year, the publishing house, Harlequin, sold more than 3 books per second. In Laurie Kahn's documentary film called Love Between the Covers, romance writer Beverly Jenkins sums up the popularity of romance pretty well.
You have nothing like this in science fiction. You have nothing like this in fantasy. You have nothing like this in mysteries. We are the shit.
There's a conference going on in Salt Lake City for people who study romance fiction, which is giving us an opportunity to talk about the genre, to talk about the industry, the stories, the community, the romance, of course. Laurie Kahn is with us, filmmaker, resident scholar at Brandeis University's Women's Studies Research Center, and her films include A Midwife's Tale, which earned her an Emmy Award for Outstanding Nonfiction. She also was involved in the American Experience documentary Tupperware, which is really great. It won a Peabody. And she's joining us here in the studio. We'll be talking about her film, Love Between the Covers, in a moment. But Laurie Kahn, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And William Gleason is with us, professor and chair of English at Princeton University. He specializes in American literature and culture. He was an advisor on the film. And Professor Gleason, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Love Between the Covers is screening tonight at 6 o'clock. It's part of the International Conference on Popular Romance. We'll give you details about that as we go along. Laurie Kahn, you first. What got you started thinking about all of this as a film subject, as an idea anyway?
So I'm really interested in telling stories that other people aren't telling. Yeah. And I think that women's stories don't make it to the screen nearly often enough. And there are so many great stories. And I'm interested in women's communities and how they work because they're always dismissed.
Yeah.
So my previous films, as you mentioned, one was based on the diary of an 18th century midwife, takes you into early American history through a woman's eyes. Another is on the early years of Tupperware, another great female community.
That's a classic film, by the way, that you made.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really great. Anyway, keep going. Sorry.
And
but I get the idea. Community is absolutely it, isn't it?
So I hear about a huge, very successful community of women that's completely dissed by everybody else. That's a green light for me. It's like, oh, I'm going to look into that.
Professor Gleason, what got you thinking about and interested in the subject?
Well, it's interesting. I've long taught American popular fiction, starting in the colonial period. The earliest best-selling American text was a doomsday poem about the end of the world. Hmm. And in the syllabi that I constructed, I discovered that love was almost at the center of every text, but I wasn't actually teaching a so-called romance novel.
Yeah.
I always have my students vote for the final book of the course. And one year, the students voted to read a romance novel.
Wow.
And it opened my eyes.
But wait, when they said, let's read a romance novel, you, as a professor at Princeton, thought what? What was your reaction? Be honest.
Actually, that's not quite what they said.
Oh, it's okay.
What they said was they would read the number one paperback bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list on the Sunday after Thanksgiving.
Right.
And it turned out to be a romance novel.
Got it.
And so they were bound to read it.
Yeah.
But a later course did say, we want to read one of these books. So since that time, I've always included romance explicitly as a genre in my courses. And I became interested in the form, in the history. Mm. I'm really a 19th century American literary historian, and it's just fascinating to see the origins of the genre and where it's gone
yeah.
today.
We'll come back to the history because I want to spend some time with it, as Laurie Kahn does in the film. What's the film about? You say this, it's about pride and about prejudice. Such a nice allusion there to Jane Austen. But the prejudice part, the pride part, talk a little bit about that. The dist is sort of the word that comes up from
time. I mean, many people I interviewed told me different variations of the story of being on the beach, being on a train, on a bus, and a complete stranger walks up to them and says, why do you read that trash? I mean, that would never happen to a guy reading Stephen King or James Patterson or any of the other sort of guy genre novels. So why is it? And the other thing is people all say, oh, they're so formulaic, they're all the same. But wait a second. If in a mystery there's a dead body at the beginning, guaranteed it will be solved by the end. Justice will be served.
Yeah. So why? Why is it? I mean, the point is made in the film, and I can't remember her name offhand. It'll come to me in a moment. She says it's because it's women. They're written by women for women, and that's the essential core reason?
By women, for women, about women.
About women, right.
And, that is, I think, fundamentally why it's dissed. I mean, I think the covers have something to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Because they look cheesy or something.
People,
yeah.
But you know, the covers for James Patterson don't look so great. I mean, you know, I do think it's because it's a female thing. It's like, why are teachers paid less than other professions? Nurses pay. I mean, anyway, I do think it's a phenomenon of very, very deep prejudice
yeah.
that people aren't even aware of because it's just so much in the air.
William Gleason, is it a new – this is not a new idea, women writing for women about women.
Right.
I mean, and this comes up in the film, this idea. It drove Nathaniel Hawthorne crazy that these books were selling so well in the 19th century.
Right, and the prejudice isn't new.
Right.
I mean, part of it is a cultural squeamishness that goes way back about love, about human sexuality, about the kind of intimate emotional connection that – by and large, women have been more interested in writing about and reading about than male writers have, although that's a generalization. But yes, in the 19th century, women writers were the best-selling authors,
yeah.
and they wrote domestic fiction about relationships that usually ended happily. And this was something that the more elite authors like Hawthorne simply couldn't stomach. They didn't know why they couldn't get into that market, why their books, which ended with women chastised, ostracized, or dead, couldn't crack the bestseller list.
Let me play a clip from the film. This is Jane Ann Krentz. And she makes a point which I want to really get to. She talks about how the core values that we learn in a culture don't come from institutions. They come from our popular culture. That's essentially what she says. Let me play this moment from the film so we can talk about it.
People complain that nobody understands what core values are anymore, but that's baloney. We read them. We know exactly what a hero is supposed to do. We may not do it ourselves, but we sure know what the truth is. And we learn that not so much from the institutions, but from our popular fiction. And that's why it survives. We need it.
What does she mean, we need it?
So Jane Krentz has this theory that she describes as Jane's theory of genre fiction. It's broader than just romance. It's about all genre fiction, that it all ends happily. And the way you get your happy ending is by becoming more honorable, loyal, tenacious, better able to love, more courageous. All of these fundamental values that we have, that we want to shape characters and be shaped ourselves, and that all genre fiction ends with a happy ending where justice is served. And how do you get there? You get there by learning really fundamental virtues.
Like the hero's journey?
It's the hero's journey and the heroine's journey.
And the I shouldn't have put it that way. You're exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah. So it's the heroine's journey.
It's
right.
Both. And in a good romance novel, both characters become better people because of their relationship. And then they are, you know, bonded by the end. But, you know, it's that process of learning how to be a more virtuous, better person. And, you know, mind you, it's also books that are page turners.
Yeah, that doesn't
and fun.
Doesn't hurt. Right. What do you think about that, Professor?
Popular fiction has always, almost by definition, tried to give readers a picture of the things that matter to them most. So if you are in the 19th century or in the 20th century or in the 21st century, one of the things that matters to you most are the people who are closest to you and what it means to be intimate with them emotionally, physically. So popular romance gives readers an image of what those relationships are like. Their ups and downs, their anxieties, the tension that they may not work out is always an element of the romance novel. There's always that moment in the book where you think this is just impossible, and then it's overcome. And it delivers the satisfaction of the image of the possible successful union.
There are a number of characters that play out in the film. I want to talk about a few of them. Let's start with Mary Bly. Eloisa James is her name. Does she go by both, by the way?
She does now. For years, she kept her romance identity secret.
Yeah. Which is telling in of itself, is it not?
Yeah. I mean, she's an academic, and she was told by the chair of her department that she should keep it quiet, that she had this double identity as, you know, Eloisa James. She wouldn't get tenure. Well, now she's got tenure.
Yeah.
So she can do whatever she wants.
Is that right? As soon as she got tenure, she was like, all right, I'm going public. Well, it's Mary Bly. You may recognize the name Bly, of course. It's from her father's a famous poet, Robert Bly, Iron John fame. And her mother, a Carol Bly, acclaimed writer of essays and short stories. So these are legit people. And so when their daughter comes to them and talks to them about the fact that she has this affection for, which you explore in the film, romance, they don't know what to do with it. Here's Mary Bly talking in Laurie Kahn's film.
I only wanted to read novels, and most of the house was poetry. So I read everything I could in order to get at the romances. So they already knew I had a weakness, so to speak, from their point of view. My mother was horrified, plain old horrified. You know, she said, well, I just don't understand. Why don't you write? Why don't you just try to write like Tolstoy? Why don't you just give it a shot? You could be good at it.
I can't imagine she was hard to get for the film, right? I mean, she's pretty, or was it difficult? Did you have to talk her into it?
Well, it wasn't difficult in the sense that she likes to talk out and sort of be public about the subject now. But I sent her an initial email in which I talked about romance novels, romance fiction as formulaic. And she wrote back and said, no, no, no. You know, you need to study up. Here's some books you need to read. Huh. And I went and I did my reading and I then emailed her back and she saw that I was serious about it and I wasn't just coming in to mock everybody and mock the genre. So once she knew I was okay and open-minded.
And you were going to take it seriously.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's a tenured professor who studies and lectures about Shakespeare at Fordham. So I'm interested in this question of Shakespeare actually comes up, like Romeo and Juliet, which we'll get to in a moment. This idea of tragedy, I think, is really interesting. But let's just talk about quality, which is a subjective thing I understand completely. But I was thinking about why is it that people dismiss it? And I think there's this impression that, set aside the formula part, set aside the covers, set aside the popularity, there's this sense that it's just not very well written. And the ends have something to do with it, I think, for a lot of people. That the fact that there is almost always, or generally, right, a happy ending. What's it called? H-E-A.
Happily ever after.
I mean, that's an acronym that comes up from time to time in the film and in this community. So I wanted to get you both to talk about this general perception that because it's so quote-unquote popular, it's tawdry, it's pedestrian, it's not really great literature. What do you make of that?
So this is a perception that's central to the prejudice against romance, but you also find it in other popular genres. The truth of the matter is romance has a spectrum of aesthetic quality, just like other genres, including literary fiction, which is itself a genre.
Of course.
There is superb literary fiction. There's some awful literary fiction. There is superb romance, aesthetically complex, satisfying romance. And there's some that is simply not very good. Yeah. That's just the nature of writing. It's important, you mentioned Shakespeare, to remember that Shakespeare was not always the high culture figure that we associate today. So today you say Shakespeare and you think you're invoking simply timeless high literary quality. In the 19th century, Shakespeare was a popular literary form, especially in the United States. Yeah. He was pop culture.
Right.
He was treated that way. So genres, reputations, literary quality also shift over time. I think one of the most important things that the romance scholar community has done is identify what makes romance fiction aesthetically complex. Mm. And by treating individual titles, by addressing the work of single authors, rather than simply lumping all romance fiction to one big generalizable category, has enabled us to see that complexity. It's the same thing that had to happen with literary fiction, because the novel itself was a base genre when it first emerged in the 18th century.
Yeah. And seen as not worthy, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And largely because it addressed women readers. The novel, which we now think of as the highest literary form, and we don't connect romance fiction to the novel, they have the same trajectory.
What do you think?
About quality.
Yeah, the quality question.
I totally agree with what Bill just said. I would add to it that romance authors, to survive economically, write 2 to 4 books a year. So the fact that some of them are as well written as they are is astounding. I couldn't do it. So I think that's part of the equation. And I also think that people think of bodice rippers when they think romance.
For sure.
And so they're thinking about novels that were written in the 70s and 80s. And the field of romance has exploded since then. It used to be historical bodice rippers, you know, that with Fabio on the cover. But now there's everything from evangelical Christian romance, where it's very chaste, to historical suspense, paranormal with vampires and werewolves, African-American, lesbian, male-male, BDSM. I mean, and I've left out 20. So there's a huge range there. And so the kind of purple prose that everybody has in their head, you know, some woman sobbing in her bed, eating bonbons, reading purple prose, it's not the case anymore.
Yeah. It's a great scene. There's this moment where Mary Bly is talking to, and this is part of the story, which we'll get back to, this sort of collaboration, this sharing, this mentoring that goes on, which is amazing. And Mary's talking to a writer. And she says, all right, if you're not going to sell to the inspiration, what is it? The evangelicals, essentially, the inspiration class.
Inspirational novels.
Inspirational novels.
That's the lingo.
Yeah, that's the lingo. If you're not going to sell to them, then you've got to include some sex. Like you've got to spice this up a little bit, which I thought was really fascinating, which gives you a sense of the range that's there. And you explore that range in particular people, African-American Beverly Jenkins, which we'll talk a little bit about when we come along, and also lesbian novels. That's another part that comes into this. But I wanted, well, you mentioned Bodice Rippers, which does raise a question, which is kind of a feminist critique. Germaine Greer, of course, was one of the first. She hated bodice rippers, and she called this kind of genre, she said it enslaved women, essentially, that it made them submissive. And you hear these critiques from time to time. I guess you probably still do. What do you make of that, Laurie Kahn?
I'd say the opposite is true for the most part these days. Female characters in romance novels tend to be strong. And they are not passive virgins. They're executives and journalists and business people. And, you know, they have all sorts of they're Navy SEALs. They're kick-ass. And some of them have knitting shops, you know, the heroines. There's a whole spectrum.
Right.
And where else in our culture are women always center stage? Where else in our culture are women allowed to explore their own desires and not mocked for it, or not, it's taken seriously. Their desires are explored unapologetically in these books. And the heroine gets the really great guy because, not because that makes her life complete, but because she can learn to be a better person and overcome all these obstacles that get thrown in her way.
You get a sense that people who are doing these critiques don't actually read the books.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's right?
I would say that's true of everybody I know who said, oh, my God, are you writing about – you're doing a film about romance novels? And I say, have you read it one in the last 20 years?
Yeah.
And I also say, have you read Jane Austen? I mean, she's the ur-mother of romance novels.
Yeah. What do you think about the feminist critique part? Surely you've thought about this.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a great question because the earliest serious scholarly critique of romance fiction was from a feminist perspective, and it was intensely critical. And that's evolved. But it's not resolved.
No.
I think that there are still legitimate arguments within the scholarly community over what is and isn't feminist about romance fiction. But that's a healthy conversation to have. What is or isn't feminist about almost any part of American popular culture? But it's no longer the presumption that the feminist perspective on romance fiction must be dismissive, because there are incredibly empowering feminist ideals that can be found in these texts.
One quote, one story that Mary told that didn't make it into the film is that they frequently give romance novels to women in battered women's shelters and
wow.
Say, look, this woman got out of a bad relationship. She ran into all of these obstacles along the way, and she found a decent, loving, nonviolent relationship. And you deserve that too, and you can have it. You don't have to put up with a violent relationship. And it inspires a lot of women to change their lives.
You want to say something about Kim? Because Kim sort of fits into this part, I think, of the story. She's well, tell her story because she's great.
So Kim Castillo.
Castillo.
Was a reader. So she grew up in a trailer much of her life in Indiana, Elkhart, Indiana. And she stumbled into reading romance when she was working at a factory. She never got past high school, but they had a cardboard box in the library and in the factory that was their de facto library. And she discovered romance fiction and loved it. And she was already a huge reader, devoured everything. And so she was reading lots and lots of romance novels, and she really loved the work of Mary Bly / Eloisa James and wrote her a letter. And Mary says, I got lots of letters. I always answer my letters. But Kim's was really articulate. So they start up a conversation, and they start exchanging, you know, letters and emails, and then they start talking on the phone. And Mary starts running her books by Kim to get her feedback because Kim is such an every woman reader.
Totally. On the ground perspective. Yeah.
Absolutely. She understands what is going to speak to you know, a really passionate romance reader. She's one. And Mary will try things out and go, am I going too far? What do you think about this? And so they became really good friends. And there was also a bulletin board of started by very early internet age by like six different romance authors. And that became a community of women who were reading those authors who bonded. I mean, they're best friends for life, these people. Yeah. So Kim is part of that. And eventually Mary's got a full-time job. She's a professor and she's writing, you know, two, three romance novels a year. And she's got two kids and a husband and a life. And so she would say to Kim, oh, my God, I've just got so much to do. And Kim would say, Mary, I can help you. And Mary would say, oh, that's so nice of you, Kim, but come on, come on. And the next time Mary said, oh, it's too much. I mean, actually, her daughter was in the hospital when this happened. And there were many times that Kim offered. Finally, Mary's daughter's in the hospital. Kim offers again. And she says, well, and Kim gets a message on her voicemail saying, Kim, I've got a proposition for you. And Kim tells this story about she gets the message, she calls her, and it's like the heavens opened up. She was like, oh, my God. So she hired Kim as her assistant, and it made her life a lot easier. It was part-time. So other authors were saying, God, I'm just so overwhelmed. Mary said, oh, Kim's really helpful. Why don't you hire Kim? So Kim started a business called Author's Best Friend, helping all these authors with Facebook, Twitter, newsletters, you know, book releases, parties, whatever, book signings. And it's what keeps her family going. I mean, this is somebody who never got past high school, who worked in a factory.
Bill Gleason, is that, that seems like one of the unique dynamics of this genre, that give and take relationship between writer and reader. And you get a sense, and I'm not, I don't want to oversimplify literary fiction, that seems more isolated. It seems like a more of an individual kind of task. This seems more communal. And for some reason, they seem more willing to share.
Yes. Literary fiction is definitely not involved in the community response.
Yeah.
How should I end my next novel?
Right.
But genre fiction is more interested in cultivating the readership, but then also listening and responding to them.
Yeah.
And I see it in other genres. I see it in mystery. Writers have to go out on tour.
Sure.
They have to be on Facebook. But the romance community is different. And it is more intense. And it has something to do with what Kim says in her segment, that picking up those books from that box didn't simply alert her to, oh, I like reading this genre. It modeled for her relationships she didn't see in her own life.
Yeah.
It taught her how to enter a loving relationship. And it changed her life in that way. It's not just a good read.
Yeah.
It gave her a way to think about her life differently.
Yeah, and she raised her expectations for a relationship and she finds the man of her dreams because she sets her standard high.
Yeah.
And we thankfully get to meet him in the film, which is nice too.
Yeah.
Lori Kahn is with us. William Gleason. Lori is director of Love Between the Covers. William Gleason, chair of Princeton University's English department. They're both in town for the International Conference on Popular Romance hosted by the University of Utah. Tonight at 6 o'clock at the Marmalade Library in Salt Lake City, there's a free screening of the film. You should come. It's going to be followed by a Q&A with Lori Kahn. We have details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about romance fiction. There's a big conference going on in Salt Lake City for people who study the genre. And you can dismiss it if you want, but it's a hugely popular genre, $1 billion in annual sales. And there's this argument that romance pays the bills for the rest of the book industry. So why is it seen as shallow and tawdry and badly written? Well, we're talking about that, the literary strengths and values and community in romance fiction. Lori Kahn is with us. She's the director of the film Love Between the Covers, which is going to be a screening tonight at 6 o'clock at the Marmalade Library in Salt Lake City. We'll give you more details about that. William Gleason also with us. He's featured in the film. He's the chair of Princeton University's English department. All right, I want to play a clip from Nora Roberts, who's great. She holds her own, for sure. And it brings up this question of tragedy. What's romance? What's not? What's tragic? What's not? And and Nora Roberts has a very clearly defined sense of what is romance and what is not. And from her perspective, as you'll hear in this, is Romeo and Juliet, that's not a romance, for at least by her definition of it. And we should explain. I looked her up this morning. Her net worth, Nora Roberts, is listed as $350 million. This just gives you a sense how well these guys are doing. And here's Nora Roberts from the film, Laurie Kahn's film, Love Between the Covers.
If I'm reading a murder mystery and they don't find out who done it, I'm going to be a little pissed off at the end, because that's my reader expectation. At the end of a romance, I want love to have conquered all. I want them to have worked for it. But I want that. And if at the end, I mean, that's, you know, people will say, well, Romeo and Juliet. And I will say, no, not a romance, tragedy. And there were two stupid teenagers who committed suicide. It is not romantic. It is not a romance. When I pick up a romance, I want a great story with interesting people who go on a journey together.
Now, William Gleason, I can't imagine, is there a consensus in this genre that, in fact, Romeo and Juliet doesn't fit? Because this whole question of whether or not there has to be a happy ending or, you know, all of that, is there consensus? I mean, what do you make of this idea? Because couldn't Romeo and Juliet be a romantic way of thinking about an ending?
It depends where you look, and it depends when you look.
Right.
So this is very interesting. The HEA, the happily ever after ending, is a core principle of the Romance Writers of America. So the American Organization for Romance Writers insists that there be an optimistic, satisfying ending. But the British romance writers don't have that qualification. So British romance writers might actually include Romeo and Juliet or Anna Karenina or other texts that have an intense emotional relationship in them. That's what we often think of when we think of Romeo and Juliet, the balcony scene, not the suicide.
Right.
So it depends. Different cultures define romance differently. In America, the happy ending is crucial, although it wasn't always that way. In the 19th century, when the genre was first emerging, there were texts that ended happily, and there were texts that ended uncertainly, texts that ended in a kind of emotional gray area. And as the genre found its footing, it moved toward the happy ending as the requirement, but it wasn't always that way.
I mentioned in the introduction at the top of the show, Jennifer Cruzy, which is a pseudonym. I didn't realize Jennifer Smith is her actual name, right? And she's in the film and she's great. But she makes this argument, and you've written about this, Professor, this idea that people think that romance is not as realistic as literary fiction. But she makes this case, and you've written about this, that no, it's more realistic to get the guy or to have the good relationship. That people throwing themselves off bridges is the more unrealistic sort of thing. Would you say something about that? I find that really interesting.
Right. I mean, one of the things that Cruzy argues is that romance fiction is actually emotionally realistic and is more in tune with the way people actually live their lives than the extremities of most tragic fiction. As you say, most lives don't end in the kind of double suicide or the suicide murder, the kinds of extreme acts of violence that often end tragic fiction.
Yeah.
Extreme acts of disappointment. Yes, there is disappointment in human life, but there's just as much contact and connection and love. And so I think Cruzy's right. I think romance fiction, because it ends happily, is thought simply to be not accurate, not realistic, and certainly not literarily valuable.
I want to talk about this bookstores, because this comes up in the film. There's a woman by the name of Courtney Milan, whom we meet, She's talking about the fact that when you go into a bookstore, a kind of a conventional bookstore, you often get a kind of snobbery when you ask for a romance. And they don't really cover, they don't really have them all, as Courtney mentions in this moment. And this sort of raises the idea, and it's given popularity to some e-readers, because romance writers don't, I mean, what's it like, I guess, if you're looking for a romance book, to wander into a local bookstore? They don't get treated very well sometimes. At least that's the impression that this Courtney Milan mentions. She's a writer, by the way. Yeah.
Yep. I think it depends whether it's a Barnes & Noble. Big Barnes & Nobles have huge romance sections that are selling more than any other section of the bookstore. But your classic independent bookstore might have sci-fi and mystery, but not romance. It's beneath them. And so in terms of bookstores and reading habits, I think that one thing to remember is that romance readers are voracious readers. And a lot of romance is written as a series, so that there's one story, but then the characters carry on. You get the secondary characters who become main characters in the next one, and then other secondary characters. So each book is a different story, but it continues the same cast of characters, the same world that they've created. And so people who love romance want to read it the same way people binge watch TV now, right? I mean, they get into it. They want to know what happens in the next book and the next book. So the whole phenomenon of the internet has changed the romance reader as a reader and also as a community, part of a community. So in one way, you know, romance readers could not, you know, at a typical bookstore, if someone's writing three books a year, your favorite author, and you want to see the, you get a book that's from a series 3 years ago and you want to read the whole series, it's not very likely that even a Barnes & Noble is going to have all of them, the whole range of them. But it's easy for a digital bookstore to have all of them in stock. And then you can just download them and continue reading. So it's, the internet has changed their lives completely, and they're reading it on a Kindle or some other device where nobody sees the cover. Somebody isn't going to walk up to them on the beach or on the train and say, why do you read that trash? Because no one knows what they're reading. But also, the internet's totally changed their community. I mean, it used to be that readers would write to publishing houses to then pass along the letters to the authors. And now they're talking directly to the authors all the time and to each other.
Yeah. It's about access, control, and connection, right? So now romance readers can find the books they want by going online. They don't have to rely on the bookstore in their small town, let's say, that doesn't stock anything. And it lets them control what they read, where they read it, and who knows what they actually are reading. And then, as Laurie says, it builds contact between readers and writers, between readers and other readers. It's been probably the genre that has most successfully taken advantage of what the digital revolution has brought to publishing.
Do you have a sense that some bookstores who don't like to stock these kinds of books are missing an opportunity here? And do you think they feel or should feel threatened? I mean, a lot of the innovations going on in publishing, it seems like many important ones, are playing out in this particular genre.
Yeah. I mean, all bookstores are threatened right now.
True.
But I think you have to make a very conscious decision, if your job is to sell books and to make money selling books, that there's a genre that you won't stock because you don't personally respect it or believe in it. So I would imagine that that there are some booksellers who will come or have come to regret that position.
William Gleason is with us. He's chair of the Princeton University English Department. Laurie Kahn, director of Love Between the Covers, both in town for the International Conference on Popular Romance hosted by the University of Utah. There's a screening of the film tonight at the Marmalade Library in Salt Lake City. It's free. There's going to be a Q&A. Laurie Kahn will be there. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with William Gleason and Laurie Kahn talking about romance novels. There's a conference going on, people who study the genre, and Laurie Kahn's made a terrific film called Love Between the Covers, which is screening tonight. I'll give you details about that. So it's giving us a chance to talk about romance novels. Let's take a call, because I think it's a good question here. Jenny is with us in Salt Lake. Jenny, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
First of all, I just wanted to say that I love the pun of the film name. It's
Thanks.
Hilarious. I also, my question was about the explicit sex scenes in romance. It's kind of one of the things that sets romance apart. And I'm just wondering if you think that contributes to or maybe takes away from some of the higher brow things you're talking about.
Yeah, what is there always explicit sex in
this so stuff? There's a whole range.
Yeah.
I mean, the evangelical inspirational books, everything happens behind closed doors except for kisses.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, if it's a paranormal with a vampire, it might be a little different. So there's this whole range of how the term in the business is how hot is it, right? So it's for everything from quite, you know, chaste and cool-ish, warm, all the way to super hot. And I think people get their signals from the covers often of whether it's the kind of book that they like to read.
What most romance readers will say is that the sex is part of the book, but not the essence of the book. That
yeah.
It's the emotional connection between the hero and the heroine, or the heroine and the heroine, or the hero and the hero, whatever the combination may be. That's what they read for. And the sex is there. But some romance readers even say, they skip the sex scenes. So they're not necessarily essential to the book, although, of course, they are important and they do help define the genre.
I wanted to thanks very much, by the way, for the call. Here's a question. This is from Ted. Ted writes, it seems like the best genre fiction can transcend the limits of genre and achieve legitimate and broad literary acclaim, like Ray Bradbury and Ursula Gwynn, Philip K. Dick, and Arthur Conan Doyle. Maybe J.R. Tolkien. He says, I wonder where the examples are of romance fiction that are elevated to wider literary acclaim.
Well, I mean, if you think that Jane Austen is a writer deserving of high literary acclaim, then what you're saying is the woman who invented the modern romance novel, who took that early form and said, I'm going to focus on the emotional connection. I'm going to write about love and the way it happens in the domestic parlor. That's what I'm going to write about. If you think that's high literary acclaim, then that's what romance has achieved.
There is a I wanted to ask about some of these sections. There's Lynn, is it Barrett?
Lynn Barrow.
Barrow, forgive me. She's the author of this popular Radcliffe series, and she's featured in the film. I'm not sure if she's still a working surgeon, but she was a working surgeon writing three books a year. You ask her this great question off camera, like, how do you have time to write? And she says, I write fast, which is pretty remarkable, but would you talk a little bit about her story and about this other really touching part of the film where you have another community here plugging in through romance?
So Lynn Barrow grew up in upstate New York. Her family were all garment workers. They didn't have any money. And she got it into her head reading Dr. Kate that she wanted to be a doctor. And sure enough, you know, no one in her family had been to college, but she became a doctor. She was really determined. She's a lesbian. She discovers that when she's basically – she didn't have a word for it. I mean, she says, I didn't even know what to call myself. I just knew I was different. And she gets to college and has her first relationship with another woman, and she tells this amazing story in the film. But she still – there was no lesbian fiction that ended well.
Yeah.
It all – like – you know, the very famous, you know, books of the day when she was growing up, if you were a lesbian, it wasn't good. And basically, you would either go crazy or commit suicide by the end of the book. And when she was a medical student in Philadelphia at University of Pennsylvania, she discovered Giovanni's Bookstore is the oldest gay and lesbian bookstore in the country. And she discovered a lesbian romance novel that ended happily. And she was like, oh my God, I thought I'd gone to heaven. And she started writing romance and wrote all the way through her surgical career. And then her writing became more a part of her life. And she's left medicine recently, and she started a publishing house, Bold Strokes Books, that publishes gay and lesbian authors.
And then you hear then from some of the women you talk to who are reading these books, such hope that finally their stories are being told. And you don't just hear that in this particular part, but there's the Beverly Jenkins part of the story, African-American women hearing their stories then reflected in popular fiction. That seems to be one of the really important elements of the story. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, Beverly Jenkins is an African-American romance author. She and Brenda Jackson, who appears in the film also, just wrote. They were voracious readers, and they wrote all the time. Yeah. But they were told by publishing houses, there's no such thing as black love. And they were like, what? Really? I mean, Brenda says, I think my life is an example of it. And Beverly's like, you know, come on, we're a community. So it was not until the 80s that people started publishing African-American romance. And I think it was people talk about walking across an airport and seeing black people on the cover of a romance novel and doing a double take. And there is a very strong community. I mean, I went on a trip to Charleston, South Carolina with Beverly and her readers. They take a trip together every other year to a historical place where one of Beverly's novels is set. And they know more history than the guides do. They're really exploring their own roots, their own history, and they have a damn good time while they're doing it. And I also went on a cruise to Alaska with Brenda Jackson and 200 of her readers, you know, talking about her romance series while floating through pristine wilderness. I mean, they are there for each other. They find each other, and they don't just talk about books. They talk about everything.
The segment in the film where they visit the Charleston Slave Mart is so powerfully moving. And it's so clear that her mission in writing is to bring histories to her readers, as well as emotion, as well as love, but to bring knowledge of a past that is at its core potentially horrible and yet has been survived. And it's giving knowledge. It's giving access to a past that might otherwise simply be painful, something people wouldn't want to approach.
Well, it gets at something, Professor, you've written about, and that is you write about that these are the stories that we tell ourselves about our own cultures, that we work out some kind of problem or some kind of question that, as you've written here, that might be as basic as who are we, where do we belong, what is our future? I mean, this gives you a sense of the core element of you know, behind this kind of genre, this kind of writing.
Yeah, this is one of the powers of genre fiction, and it's a particularly potent power of romance fiction. And you see it throughout the film. You see it in so many of the protagonist stories, that what romance did was give them a mirror for their own lives, but also provide a window onto lives that they may not have been familiar with. And that's a powerful, powerful thing for fiction to do, to write our stories and to put down in words and thus in imagination and make visible in our heads and then possibly in our real lives the kinds of things we strive for and to understand ourselves. I mean, that's what good fiction of any kind does. Romance fiction wants to help its readers understand themselves and love themselves. And that's powerful.
Which makes it all the more a shame that there's this sort of segregation of all of this now. And I'm wondering, I'm not sure if you can pinpoint this, when did we get the brows? You know what I mean? The high brows.
Oh, absolutely.
And the low brows.
No, we pretty much know when we got them.
Really?
I mean, in the United States, we got them roughly after the Civil War. Huh. So before the Civil War, you have a kind of largely undifferentiated publishing milieu. And so materials would come into the house and they might be the family newspaper and they'd be read by everyone and different sections would be read by different people. But after the Civil War, with the rise of the profitability of publishing and greater distribution networks, you have the opportunity to target specific audiences, not just by topic, but by supposed brow. And it's after the Civil War, late 19th century, early 20th century, that we get distinct divisions between highbrow, middlebrow, and lowbrow. So our categories and our judgments and our assessments come from that historical moment. And ironically, they have to do with the opportunity to publish more and distribute more and get more things to more readers. But then what it does is create scales of judgment.
Here's an email that comes from Hannah. Hannah writes, I'm a proud romance reader. I have been for just under 10 years. Practically all I read is nonfiction and romance. She says, I'm teased by my husband for reading them, but I also have incredible literary, critical, anthropological, historical conversations with other women who read this kind of – and that comes through in the film, we should mention. But Hannah writes, I don't mind so much that most men don't get it. It makes me feel like I'm in an exclusive feminine and feminist club. And isn't that sort of the overarching theme in some ways, that this community, this club?
It's a club that welcomes everybody and anybody. It's not an exclusive club. And if you're interested in what's in these books, it's like, come on in. And if you want to write them, it's like, come on in. We'll show you how to write them. I mean, I don't think there are other writers' groups that allow people who haven't been published at their conferences and run workshops to teach them how to become writers. And I think that it's this safe environment in which women can explore what they're interested in. And it crosses class. It crosses, lots of boundaries that are in our everyday lives. And, you know, what Mary says, one thing that I think is quite interesting, that it's one of the last meritocracies left, that cooking is a meritocracy. Anybody who's a really good cook can become a famous chef. But there aren't many places in life where that's true. And, you know, Nora Roberts never got past high school. She's worth $350 million. And, you know, people become writers who have PhDs, and people become writers who never graduated high school.
Laurie Kahn, she's the director of the film Love Between the Covers. It's going to be screening tonight. Laurie's going to be there for a Q&A, so you should go. 6 o'clock at the Marmalade Library in Salt Lake City. We have details on our website. Laurie Kahn, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And William Gleason, chair of Princeton University's English Department. He specializes in American literature and culture. He was an advisor in the film. You'll see him there as well. Professor, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.